From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
Canadians are notoriously polite. If you bang into us, we'll say we're sorry. This is just the Canadian way. Our key to survival has been to lay low, stay quiet, and maybe the polar bear or the grizzly bear will walk by you if you play dead.
Canadian film critic Catherine Monk. We'll talk to her about Canadian cinema today as we focus our attention on our neighbor to the north, Canada. Ever wonder what it's like to grow up in the shadow of the most powerful nation in the world?
You're looking at it from the outside, you study it from the outside. You know, like you're a kid, not the popular one in the schoolyard, but there's the clique. You know everything about them, but they know nothing about you in a sense.
That's Kyle McCullough, a Canadian writer for the American animated TV series South Park, a show that often makes fun of Canada. Also, a profile of one of the world's greatest short story writers, a Canadian named Alice Munro.
She's not going in there with some modest sense of, I'll spend 3 days and here will be a slice of life. She's going in there trying to recreate the entirety of a life. And then it gets shrunk down to a story, and it's a long story.
A few years ago, a Canadian brewery produced a beer commercial that really hit a nerve among Canadians. The commercial earned standing ovations in bars and cinemas. It was even performed at a Stanley Cup hockey playoff game. Here it is.
Hey, I'm not a lumberjack or a fur trader, and I don't live in an igloo or eat blubber or own a dog sled. And I don't know Jimmy, Sally, or Susie from Canada, although I'm certain they're really, really nice. I have a prime minister, not a president. I speak English and French, not American, and I pronounce it about, not a boot. I can proudly sew my country's flag on my backpack. I believe in peacekeeping, not policing, diversity, not assimilation, and that the beaver is a truly proud and noble animal. A toque is a hat, a Chesterfield is a coach, and it is pronounced Zed, not Z.
So you remember that map that popped up on websites right after the U.S. presidential election? A vast sea of red states in the center and around the edges a big swath of blue called the United States of Canada? And the idea was that Democrats might have more in common with Canadians than with their fellow Americans in the red states. Or maybe those disenchanted blue staters would be better off just moving to Canada. Well, Michael Adams has a few thoughts on these matters. Adams is the president of the Environics Group of Research and Communications Consulting Companies. He's also the author of Fire and Ice, The United States, Canada, and the Myth of Converging Values.
In 1992, when we first did our survey in the United States, we'd been doing surveys in Canada for a long time. We found that in Canada, about 26% of Canadians strongly or somewhat agreed that the father of the family must be the master of the house. And that had been declining every year since we first began surveying in Canada in 1983. We went into the field in the United States, and in that first year, we found that 42% of Americans thought dad must be the boss in the house. So he had 42% versus 26%. And I remember presenting this in St. Louis, and a gentleman got up and he said, Mr. Adams, did you only survey in Texas? And I said, no, we did the whole country from Boston right over to San Francisco. And he said, well, you know, you advertised that one of them 20 surveys could be wrong. Would you go back in the field? So in 1996, we went back and we found 22% of Canadians thought father must be master, so it was decreasing. And in the U.S., 42 became 44%. So we became a bit suspicious that there was something going on here. First, the two countries were different. Secondly, the gap was growing wider. In the year 2000, Canadians were down at 18%. And as Americans were about to vote for George Bush or Al Gore in the year 2000, the American numbers were 49%. So the U.S. had gone from 42 up to 49, believing in patriarchal authority. The Canadians had gone from 26 down to 18. Now, Jim, for me as a sociologist, anthropologist, or whatever, pollster, whatever I am, this is pure gold because it is a measure of an orientation to the structure of authority in the most important institution nation that any of us are ever going to come across. It's the family, which, of course, shapes our values. It has a huge influence on us, at least to the age of 10, sometimes up to 15, depending on what kind of family you've got. And, of course, those fundamental orientations to authority express themselves not just in the way the family runs itself, but, of course, we take those attitudes to the workplace, to the consumer marketplace, to the political marketplace. And so here I was seeing something that was startling to me, that Canadians and Americans would be going in divergent directions when we, of course, seemed on the surface to share those values, whether it was, you know, a father knows best, or all in the family, or Murphy Brown, or now Will and Grace. You would think we both, you know, all been exposed to these images of families, and how is it that the Canadians and the Americans are going in seemingly divergent directions?
Now, another one of the survey value statements had to do with sexism, the idea that men are superior to women. Did you get the same results with this one?
A smaller proportion, but about 10% of Canadians believe that men are naturally superior to women, and about a quarter of Americans believe that men are naturally superior to women. You could probably ask me the question, how many people believe that women are naturally superior to men? And of course, we didn't ask that question in 1992. We've only asked it on more recent surveys as people are starting to doubt which of the genders, in fact, is the superior one in public opinion. But you know what this highly correlates with, and perhaps you'll find this, or your listeners will find this surprising, maybe not, it highly correlates with religiosity. Traditional religious belief, traditional religious practice is twice as prevalent in the United States as it is in Canada. So just as Canadians have questioned traditional patriarchal authority, so too have they questioned traditional religious authority.
You've talked a lot about the kinds of feelings that people have, I guess, about their place in society. What about things? Is there a different attitude? Because we're all exposed to the same commercials. Do they have a similarly different effect in the two countries?
It's interesting. America is a country, of course, based on the myth, you could say, of the American dream, that you can go from rags to riches, that you can go from a log cabin to the White House. In this culture, the idea is that you can work very hard and you will have material gain. You'll make a lot of money, and when you do make a lot of money, you buy things to show where you are on the status hierarchy. And so Americans are very oriented to buying symbolically resonant things, objects, cars, houses, all sorts of things that tell others, tell the Joneses in the neighborhood where they are in the status hierarchy. Countries like Canada and Europe also, of course, value things, but they have come to a state of mentality that we call postmodernism, whereas modernism is, again, rising on the hierarchy, buying things that say where you are on the hierarchy. Postmodernism says, yes, I have things, I have enough things, but they're kind of weighing me down, and I'm going to put greater stress on experiences. And therefore, what you get is a sense then that I'm not going to work harder to get more money, to buy more things. I'm actually going to work less hard and enjoy the experience that may cost less money, but the experience of, let's say, reading a book, spending time with your family, maybe taking a trip somewhere, and so on. So we find the Canadians to be much more skeptical of advertising, much more questioning of whether or not they need another thing to make them feel good. Maybe not buying something will make them feel good. And again, in this respect, the Canadians have a higher proportion of postmoderns than do Americans, and again, a similar proportion that you find in Europe.
One area where I know Canadians think they're different from Americans is in their attitude toward guns and violence in general. What did you learn about that?
Well, again, traditional patriarchy, the dad is the master in the house, so you have kind of traditional attitudes about how if dad's the master and mom is playing best actress in a supporting role and the children don't speak till spoken to, or, you know, spare the rod and spoil the child and so on, we find a much higher orientation within American families. Again, there is a split between red and blue America because there are, you know, it's a big country, nearly 300 million people. So not every, I'm making generalizations that do not apply to all Americans, but there is a very high proportion of Americans who have a traditional idea than a patriarchal authority of the use of, you know, spanking of children. And it kind of applies in a wider way to, you know, how you deal with evil. So it's kind of an Old Testament version of the Bible. There are good guys, there are bad guys, there's right and wrong. And in a sense, there is almost a sense that violence, use of force, is an appropriate response to the violence perpetrated by someone else. So you get in America capital punishment, which you don't, you know, the death penalty, which you don't have in Canada or in Europe.
You've used percentages to talk about other aspects of the differences. Did you find a percentage of Americans willing to use violence, percentage of Canadians willing to use violence, and was there any change?
Well, it's about double, Jim, the proportion of Americans. It's about a quarter of Americans versus about 10% of Canadians who think it's okay. Violence is normal in everyday life. It's just letting off a little steam. My joke about the Canadians is that they only allow violence on skates, right, when they're playing hockey. But otherwise, it's not on. About a quarter of Americans believe that it's okay to use violence to get something you want. Again, about 10% of Canadians believing that violence is a normal way of getting what you want. So, you know, one is an expression, I think, of a society in which, I guess I would say it's more of a social welfare state. Another is the expression of a society that is more Darwinistic. It's more dog-eat-dog, survival of the fittest. It's the way it's always been, and it's the way it's always going to be. And America is a society that wants to, who wants to judge itself, I believe, by the exceptional person, the person who's gone from rags to riches, the person like Bill Gates who starts in a garage and ends up building the biggest computer company in the world. America wants to be judged by putting a man on the moon, by doing a breakthrough in cancer research, whereas I think the Canadians and perhaps the Europeans similarly don't want to be judged by the exception. They want to be judged by how everyone in the society is doing. And so in Canada, in Europe, the emphasis is they want to judge their societies on how are the worst off among us doing, not how are the superstars doing. And so it's really an exceptional society, the United States, because it wants to be judged by its exceptional citizens and the contributions they make to the wider world.
How do you see this cross-border conflict working out? Are Americans and Canadians going to become even more different from each other?
You know, I find as a, you know, one of the 6 billion people on this planet, the idea that we are diverging in certain ways, I find it a bit difficult to take as well, because I would like to believe that as humans, we're becoming a wiser and better species, that our children will live in a better world that we live in. And like a lot of Canadians, I probably find it difficult to even accept my own research that America may be in its current 25 or 30 year trajectory going in a different direction, and one in which maybe that view of what humans are going to do with this planet, is it going to be the war of all against all? Is it going to be us ignoring the ecology that sustains life on this planet? That America appears in, at least in some interpretations of my research, of not having that nurturing attitude toward the family, toward other people in the country, toward other people on this planet, toward the environment. So that's what makes it a bit difficult for me, because all of us, whether you're an American or a Canadian or anybody in the rest of the world, all of us have fallen in love with an America. It's a platonic conception of America. And it was maybe the America of the civil rights movement. It could be America of feminism or of Rachel Carson and environmentalism. And I think a lot of people are finding it difficult to see America going in a trajectory that is not in line with its conception that America is a good country and that America in many ways defines the best part of our future. And I think America now is at a very critical point. Is America the leader leading us into a future that we all want? Or is America leading us into a future in which the species, in fact, may find itself in such conflict with itself, with other members of its species, and with its environment, that we're going into a future that none of us wants?
Michael Adams is the author of Fire and Ice, The United States, Canada, and the Myth of Converging Values. Kyle McCullough is originally from Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. But he now finds himself living in Los Angeles, where he's a writer for Comedy Central's popular animated TV series South Park. It's a show that often makes fun of Canada. To the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon is also Canadian, so it seemed only natural to have him sit down with Kyle McCullough. McCullough told him about a South Park episode called It's Christmas in Canada.
Basically, what happens is that Canada gets a new prime minister, and one of his first acts is to ask that all Canadians who were adopted to the States or any place in the world be basically repatriated back to Canada. So that what happens is Kyle's adopted brother, Ike, who's Canadian, his parents show up and take him back to Canada. And this is just around Christmas time, so there's a whole Christmas dilemma and a Christmas message in the story. I can't even keep a straight face when I'm saying that. But it's true. It really is true.
As they get to Canada, it's a parody of the Wizard of Oz, isn't it?
Yeah, we basically took the most beloved holiday classic that spans over 2 hours long, I guess, and scrunched it into 22 minutes of actual airtime. In this episode, I do the voice of a Newfie, a Newfoundlander.
Oh, right. Would you mind doing a bit of that for us now?
Yeah, this is my, you know, generic Canadian Newfie, which is, you know, hey, boys, we're all going to go down to the boat there, and we're going to go out fishing for the cad. Hey, boys, let's tomahawk her down in the hardwood floor there. Get me some of that screech, we'll play the fiddle and dance all night in the kitchen. That's your basic Newfie.
Yeah, I feel right at home, man. Newfoundland's never been home to me.
You were in New Brunswick at one
point.
Yeah,
which is close. Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Do you have a favorite scene in the Christmas in Canada episode?
I think my favorite scene, for me personally, is just any scene where you get to see the Canadians. Well, basically, it's broken up because in The Wizard of Oz, you have the three characters that Dorothy meets. The boys meet three Canadian characters, a Mountie, a French-Canadian, and then the Newfie. So we sort of cover from coast to coast, you know, basically all of Canada. But I think my favorite scene is the musical number in Quebec, in French Canada. It's just, it just makes me laugh so hard. Like, just the everything about it.
All right, boys, prepare yourselves. We're about to enter French Canada.
French Canada?
There's no Canada like French Canada. It's the best Canada in the land. The other Canada is hardly Canada. If you lived here for a day, you'd understand.
Ha ha ha! Welcome to French Canada!
Now, this isn't the first time that South Park's creators, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, have incorporated Canada into South Park's storylines. There was, of course, a lot of Canadian content, or CanCon, in the South Park movie, bigger, longer,
nice.
And uncut.
CanCon.
Thank you. I thought you'd appreciate that, and thank
yeah,
you for appreciating me.
You get four Maple Leafs for that.
That's right. Yeah, M-A-P-L. I get them all.
Uh-huh.
So for those people who aren't familiar with it, can you give us a brief synopsis of the South Park movie?
Well, in the South Park movie, the boys go to see the movie by the two Canadian comics who fart, whose name I can't remember. So it's got a lot of farting in it. It's got, you know, curse words, I think, in it. And so the mothers are in an uproar, and they want to ban the movie, and it ends up declaring war on Canada because Canada is responsible. And so there's this big war with Canada.
But, Mr. Minister, it isn't like this film is the first troublesome thing to come out of Canada. Let us not forget Bryan Adams.
Now, the Canadian government has apologized for Bryan Adams on several occasions.
You Canadians are all the same with your beady little eyes and flapping heads. You're trash!
I resent that! I find that racist.
Our children are now addicted
to
your
film! You are racist, ma'am! You are racist!
It is going to take us weeks to erase the damage this film has done to our children!
There's also, of course, the famous song Blame Canada, which was actually nominated for an Oscar.
Yes, it was.
Times have changed! Our kids are getting worse! They won't obey their parents, they just want to fight and curse!
Should we blame the government? Or blame society?
Or should we blame the images on TV?
No! Blame Canada!
Blame Canada!
For their beady little eyes and flapping heads so long the lies!
Blame Canada! Blame Canada!
They're not even a real country anyway!
Were you involved at all in the making of the South Park film?
No.
No.
Uh-uh. Had nothing to do with it. None of the success at all.
But it was good nonetheless, despite the lack of Kyle McCullough content. Now, what was your reaction the first time you saw it?
I was blown away. Yeah. I just thought it was absolutely awesome.
You are actually Canadian. You're the only Canadian on the South Park staff. I get the sense you enjoy it, but it doesn't ever bother you at all? Like, what I'm trying to get at, I guess, is you're quite comfortable with, like, taking pot shots at your home and native land, right?
Well, look, like, if you got a sense of humor, it's, you know, like, and you somehow end up working in a business that's supposedly about comedy, then you've had to have developed a sense of humor, and usually that develops out of people taking pot shots at you and you taking pot shots back. You know, maybe as a Canadian, you're sort of used to it. You know, we are North America's Belgium, in a sense. And,
yeah.
Or, you know, like maybe the entire country is sort of the Canada version of Cleveland for America. So you hear it all the time, right? And it's just like in our circumstance, it's not based out of any sort of serious prejudice. It's this sort of like joke in a joke where it's like, yeah, we're going to make Canada this terrible evil thing when we know it's so completely innocuous. And even saying that's innocuous is offensive on a certain level to a country to say that you sort of don't matter. But I think the guys there are, you know, understand the joke.
Why do you think South Park's creators, Matt Stone and Trey Parker, like to make fun of Canada? Have you ever asked them?
Well, I think just because of what I just said. Maybe I wasn't clear, or maybe it was
No, you were
like,
clear. I just wanted to see if there was something even more specific, like it turned out that, like, Trey has an aunt who's from Newfoundland or something like that. I was going for the expose, I guess. I was trying to dig something.
Oh, the big expose?
Yeah, the big expose.
Yeah, Trey was in Vancouver and secretly married a Canadian mermaid. And that ended badly. And so now he's got a beef against all things Canadian.
Yeah, you kind of touched on this already, Kyle, but do you guys at the show ever hear from Canadians who are upset about the way that South Park portrays them and their country?
Maybe there have been letters, but I've never seen them. For a start, I think Canadians just have a sense of humor about their identity. Obviously, there's like, you know, super hardcore Canadian patriots, but I think even in Canada, when you see somebody who's very, very patriotic about any country, including their own, they're automatically suspect.
Mm-hmm.
Or do you feel that way? I mean, it seems that way to me. That, like, yeah, you're proud to be Canadian, but you feel like it's a little overboard to, you know, to say that you're proud. You just have to be secretly and quietly proud.
Yeah, exactly. It doesn't fit with sort of our reputation as being kind of quiet and modest and self-effacing. Yeah,
right, I think at this point in Canada, I think that that's sort of a virtuous ideal for people. You know, it's like they sort of very quietly brag that they are pretty modest, actually. But I think because you're on the outside looking in, you look at some of the stuff that's coming across the board in terms of like America, whether it's entertainment or whether it's news or just America itself, and it's something that's just sort of out of reach. So you're watching it, you're looking at it from the outside, you study it from the outside. You know, like you're a kid, not the popular one in the schoolyard, but there's the clique and they're all talking. You like you know everything about them, but they know nothing about you in a sense. And also I think there's that desire is like, wow, what is that place?
Kyle McCullough. He's one of the writers for the Comedy Central animated TV series South Park. He spoke with his fellow modest Canadian, to the best of our knowledge, producer Doug Gordon. If you have questions or comments about the program, we'd love to hear from you. You can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. Coming up, a profile of the great Canadian writer Alice Munro as we continue our look at Canada. Also, we'll dim the lights and explore how Canadian films differ from Hollywood films. I'm Jim Fleming. It's to the best of our knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Alice Munro is one of the few fiction writers who's practically worshipped by other writers. Mona Simpson, for instance, says Munro, rather than Bellow or Roth or Updike, is the one living writer most likely to be read 100 years from now. Reviewing her latest book, Runaway, Jonathan Franzen said, Munro has a strong claim to being the best fiction writer now working in North America. What's remarkable is that Alice Munro has earned this reputation entirely from writing short stories. And she's done it largely outside the New York publishing world. Much of her fiction is set in the small towns of southern Ontario, where she was born and where she still lives. Alice Munro is 73 years old. She rarely grants interviews, but she did talk with Steve Paulson, who also spoke with a few of her admirers, some writers, some critics. Steve has the story.
Alice Munro is not one of those writers who hits you over the head with dazzling pyrotechnics or big ideas. Her stories sneak up on you and then pack a wallop. Part of the magic is the way she condenses the essence of a life into a short space, maybe just a paragraph. Here's how her story Dulce begins.
At the end of the summer, Lydia took a boat to an island off the southern coast of New Brunswick, where she was going to stay overnight. She had noticed something about herself on this trip to the Maritimes. It was that people were no longer so interested in getting to know her. It wasn't that she had created such a stir before, but something had been there she could rely on. She was 45 and had been divorced for 9 years. Her two children had started on their own lives, though there were still retreats and confusions. She hadn't gotten fatter or thinner. Her looks had not deteriorated in any alarming way. Nevertheless, she had stopped being one sort of woman and had become another. And she had noticed it on this trip.
Charles McGrath, the former editor of the New York Times Book Review, was Alice Munro's first editor at The New Yorker.
Every one of her stories is kind of a novel compressed into miniature, and there's this kind of overflowing of character, of incident, of detail.
She's not going in there with some modest sense of, I'll spend 3 days and here will be a slice of life. She's going in there trying to recreate the entirety of a life, and then it gets shrunk down to a story, and it's a long story.
And a story, says writer Laurie Moore, that has all the pleasures of a novel. Alice Munro's stories often juggle two or even three narratives from different times in a person's life. You'll have the story that's going on right now, and then you'll suddenly be plunged back years into the past, and only later you'll find out how these two stories connect. And often there's a decisive moment you want to uncover, but as the novelist Charles Baxter points out, an Alice Munro story will keep you guessing.
It's like a Nathaniel Hawthorne story. The one moment, which is the moment of truth, is a moment that is also, in some sense, unknowable.
Many famous writers have a certain air about them, a grandiosity that comes from years of adulation. For all of her acclaim, Alice Munro is remarkably down to earth and even candid about her humble beginnings. She considers herself an old-fashioned writer, even though she's done so much to reinvent the short story. Remember the old saw about a story needing a beginning, middle, and end, and that a short story is supposed to be short? So don't her stories break all the rules?
Oh, you're telling me they don't. I didn't intentionally start out to do this. I didn't know what the rules were, I don't think.
Now, one thing that you do that you're famous for is you play with time.
Oh, yeah.
You jump back and forth between the present and the past.
I just love that.
Why? Why have you? Are you
just
so drawn?
Maybe it's because I've lived a fairly long time. And the things that happen in people's lives over time is just what interests me so much. It sometimes seems quite magical and kind of unbelievable.
Do you have a very vivid memory of past episodes of your own life?
Oh, yes. Yes. I can remember most of the people I went to school with and what color their dresses were and things like that.
Wow. You can actually remember colors of dresses?
Well, I do remember things like that, yes.
Because I know for some writers, childhood memories are especially potent. I mean, those are sort of the shaping of one's life.
Oh, well, the memory of my childhood is very strong because, as with many people's childhood, it seems to take place in a sort of different dimension. It's vivid, and it's in a world that seems lost to me now.
When you think back on your childhood, are those for the most part good years for you, or at least happy years?
I don't think they can be characterized as happy or unhappy, but I was not generally in tune with what was expected of me at school or at home, so it was a troubled childhood in some ways.
Do you think that partly made you a writer? That
yes.
In some
way
you didn't fit in?
I was just bound to become a writer because I was alone a good deal, and I didn't fit in. I didn't fit in anywhere. This is a cliche about writers. You know, you don't fit in, so you start making up your own world and you start living in your imagination or in your mind a lot.
Did you feel like you had to hide that part of yourself from other people?
Goodness, yes. It wasn't very well received. I grew up in a very practical sort of community. It was very important for people to learn how to do things. Girls learned how to do housework things, and I wasn't good at anything. I was terrible, actually. Oh, everybody suspected that I was a dreamer anyway. Everybody saw how much I read. I couldn't hide it. And I think for my own good, people wanted me to be a different kind of person. And in a way, I'm glad of this, you know, because I learned to be a pretty good housewife.
Well, I know you have often resisted reading too much autobiography into your stories, but I have to ask you about one of your early stories, The Office. There's a passage where your narrator, a housewife struggling to be a writer, says, "Here comes the disclosure, which is not easy for me. I am a writer." That does not sound right. Too presumptuous, phony, or at least unconvincing. Try again. I write. Is that better? I try to write. Was that you?
Absolutely. That is how I felt when I was a young woman. Because after all, remember, I was a housewife in the 50s. So I went on with the business of hiding myself. I'd had a long training at it. It wasn't hard for me. But just to think of being a writer, for one thing, even the writers of that period were pretty scornful of women writers, particularly housewife writers. I was always sort of trying to keep my courage up to do what I wanted to do.
Now, the story that I've heard about why you became a short story writer is that you had actually always wanted to be a novelist.
Oh, absolutely.
But you just didn't have time when you had young kids.
Well, I couldn't look forward to time. I couldn't start something and think, well, this is going to take me a year, because I didn't know what would happen in that year.
Now, is it really true that when you were starting out, when you had three young children, you were writing mainly between their naps?
Well, like when they napped, sure. That was the time I got. So I always tried to write things that I could sort of see finishing. Then that got to be, after a while, all I could do.
Alice Munro's big breakthrough, at least for American readers, came in 1977 when she published her first story in The New Yorker. Called Royal Beatings, it was based on the beatings she'd gotten from her own father. The story had nothing in common with the fiction about city and suburban people that filled The New Yorker.
We were very concerned, I was very concerned then, with getting away from the old notion of the, quote, New Yorker story, whatever that was.
Munro's editor, Charles McGrath, says that one story changed the course of modern fiction.
There was also a kind of emotional rawness. I don't think there had ever been a story in The New Yorker quite like Royal Beatings, which frankly acknowledged, I guess what you'd now call it, child abuse of a sort.
At the first, or maybe the second, crack of pain, she draws back. She will not accept it. She runs around the room. She tries to get to the doors. Her father blocks her off. Not an ounce of courage or of stoicism in her, it would seem. She runs. She screams. She implores. Her father is after her, cracking the belt at her when he can, then abandoning it and using his hands. Bang over the ear. Then bang over the other ear. Back and forth, her head ringing. Bang in the face. Up against the wall and bang in the face again. He shakes her and hits her against the wall. He kicks her legs. She is incoherent. Insane, shrieking, "Forgive me, oh please, forgive me." Flo is shrieking too, "Stop, stop." Not yet. He throws Rose down, or perhaps she throws herself down. He kicks her legs again. She gives up on words, but is letting out a noise, the sort of noise that makes Flo cry, "Oh, what if people can hear her?" The very last-ditch willing sound of humiliation and defeat it is. For it seems Rose must play her part in this with the same grossness, the same exaggeration that her father displays playing his. She plays his victim with a self-indulgence that arouses, and maybe hopes to arouse, his final sickened contempt.
There may be several reasons Alice Munro has never become a household name. She's Canadian. She only writes short stories. She tends to avoid the media. And she focuses on the lives of girls and women, to cite the title of one of her books. These aren't glamour girls. They're often smart girls from the working class, and women who want more than their mothers had, and more from the men in their lives.
What she's good at is not judging what people do. She's a feminist without being a polemicist, you know. She's looking just at the way women are, not the way they should be.
Laurie Moore says Munro has a particular interest in fate.
What happens to people? What determines how they end up? And she's very interested in the erotic pivot that determines a person's fate. You know, the erotic moment where suddenly everything changes in a person's life, instead of going one way, goes another way.
Alice Munro says love is the subject she keeps coming back to because she's always finding new ways to look at it, especially as she gets older. Her challenge as a writer is to get it right.
In describing anything, the important thing is to seek for some really accurate word that is not a fancy word. there are these dangerous subjects like sex and sunsets and things that there are all kinds of cliches available for. And yet if you really look at them and really think about them, you'll come across what is real.
I've heard writers say that you are able to write about sex, especially from a woman's point of view, like no other writer out there. How do you write well about sex?
Well, it's very difficult, I think. I mean, there's sort of a lot of traps not to fall into. But I think there are different ways of writing about sex that are successful, you know. One of them is the very detailed and explicit sort of genital description way that I don't do, but that some of the shock writers back as far as in the 60s were doing. But the things I do are a little bit cool. I wrote a story that was in the last book called What is Remembered, and that is really a story about how we look back on episodes of passion and what we try to hang on to from them.
What is Remembered is about an older woman who reflects back on a momentous day many years earlier when she was out on a drive with a man who wasn't her husband.
She was holding in a wail of disappointment, a clamor of desire. Desire that had seemed to be shy and sporadic but inevitable, yet was now, all of a sudden, declared inappropriate, one-sided. His hands on the wheel were all his own, reclaimed as if he had never touched her. She wound her window down as they crossed the Lionsgate Bridge. She asked him if he minded. No, not at all. She willed herself to silence. To the forest of the park received them, and the high, thick trees could perhaps swallow witlessness and shame. Then she spoiled everything by her too appreciative sigh. Prospect Point. He read the sign aloud. Her legs were shaking. She could not put up with this any longer. Take me somewhere else, she said. He looked in her face. He said, yes. Take me, was what she had said. Take me somewhere else. Not let's go somewhere else. That is important to her. The risk, the transfer of power. Complete risk and transfer. Let's go. That would have the risk, but not the abdication, which is the start for her, in all her reliving of this moment, of the erotic slide.
Alice Munro's stories are not to everyone's taste. Some readers find them too slow, too deliberate. But there are others, like Laurie Moore, who simply marvel at her talent.
It's just a level of greatness. You know, she has so many literary gifts, and she's just at the top of the heap.
The critic James Wood is often brutal in his appraisals, but he also raves about Munro's fiction.
The way those stories start so modestly, then begin to open up like funnels, gently folding in social detail and gentle comedy. They're extraordinary.
So what does Alice Munro make of all the fuss? She didn't seem like the kind of writer who indulges in the parlor game of ranking contemporary authors. Now, you have often been called the greatest living writer
stories. Don't say things like that because they're very embarrassing and they're not true.
But I'm sure you hear these accolades all the time.
I have heard things like that, yes. But I have a Scotch-Irish country girl's background, and you touch wood whenever praise comes to you. You know, you say, oh, I'll pay for this.
That's Alice Munro talking with Steve Paulson. Her new collection of stories is called Runaway. Thanks to Sarah Phillips for her readings.
If you're sad and like beer, I'm your lady.
Coming up, the Canadian identity, as reflected on the silver screen. We're off to the cinema to watch some Canadian films as we conclude our hour on Canada. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. We just had an email from Craig Hanks in San Marcos, Texas, who writes, I've been a semi-regular listener for many years now and sometimes catch up with the shows I missed through your website at ttbook.org. I'm also a university teacher of philosophy and have sent more than a few students and classes to the website to listen. I was especially taken with your recent Meaning of Life series. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. What can we learn about a country and its people by looking at its cinema? Well, quite a lot in the case of Canada. Catherine Monk is a Canadian film critic. She's also the author of Weird Sex and Snowshoes and Other Canadian Film Phenomena. Monk talked to Anne Strangechamps about Canadian cinema.
If you think about how Canada was colonized, certainly around the same time as the United States, by similar colonizing forces in the French and the British, what you see, I mean, a movie like Black Robe, I don't know if you've seen it, it's a movie sort of about Canada's earliest colonial days and missionaries sort of going out into the middle of the wilds and meeting all these, you know, quote-unquote savages, the First Nations peoples, and essentially being either butchered or eaten alive by the snow. But if you look at Canada just as a landscape, it's so huge and overwhelming and white and empty and hostile that you think about our early ancestors and what they decided to live in. I mean, it's absolutely insane. I mean, even just surviving a winter in early colonial Canada would have been a miracle in and of itself and a real testament, a real desire of the will, so to speak. I mean, this is just an idea that someone decided to follow through. I mean, it really makes no sense to be up here. I mean, think about it in a very strictly intellectual sense. I mean, Canada is really a land of survivors. The people that didn't die are the people that had the chance to write the history. And I think that residing underneath every single little bit of historical content, whether it's on the French side, the English side, or even on the First Nations side, which is something that we've actually had a chance to see now thanks to Atanarjuat, the Fast Runner, and its success, is this idea of survival, that these are people that decided to stick around. They are people that not only managed to survive, but in some ways perhaps even thrive. And not only that, there's also the knowledge, which I think runs all the way through the Canadian psyche, of survivor guilt, that we might have survived, but so many countless others perished. Do we deserve this fate? Do we deserve to be alive when so many other worthy people didn't?
One of the most seminal Canadian films that you write about is the 1997 movie The Sweet Hereafter, Adam McGoyan's film. And this was based on the Russell Banks novel about a school bus crash in a small town. And survival guilt just runs through that whole film, right?
Absolutely, absolutely. That's a beautiful and stark and I think a really eloquent example of how that survival guilt isn't only sort of shown on screen, because there's very little sort of in-your-face emotion considering the high drama of what takes place in that movie. I mean, a whole school bus full of kids goes down in the frigid, icy lake. We don't get the symphonic strings. We don't get sort of these grand tableaus of mourning. We see people struggling to carry on with their ordinary, boring daily routines, and how do they manage to fit what's not there into their life? How do they manage to deal around this giant gaping hole within? Adam McGoyan, I think, is a perfect example of what Canadian film directors do best, in that it's what's not said that becomes far more interesting than what is said. People criticized that film a lot in Canada. Either people loved it, loved it, loved it, and I count myself in that group, or people found it way too cold and sterile and alienating, and it just wasn't something that they felt they could warm up to, that it didn't have the sort of empathy that people expected it should have given the subject matter. I think what Egoyan does best is he sort of puts us in the void, and instead of making these connections for us, and this is something that all Canadian filmmakers generally, and I'm speaking generally, do, is they tend to fragment time, they tend to give us a broken narrative, and it's up to us as the viewer to participate and put it together. I mean, Canadian films are often called ambiguous, you know, lacking closure, that you never really know what happens, that there's no sort of rewarding ending, and things rarely ever have a happy ending in a Canadian movie. But I think that's a great challenge as a spectator, that we're not sort of spoon-fed, okay, and now the plane takes off and we see it taking off, and then the plane is in the air, and we see the plane in the air, and then we see the plane land. And You know, American films have this habit of giving us this stock footage to show us what's happening in certain time and space. And I think
Well, we're simpler people, you know.
And that's not, I mean, of course not. That's certainly not. And yet this is, you know, something that people have come to expect, I think, in a cinematic tradition. And certainly a lot of great American directors and independent directors go out there and fragment time and play with device. But, I mean, it's because America and Hollywood specifically has created this wonderful formula that we now, all of us, I think everybody on the planet, intuitively understands because it does work in a logical fashion. It fits into the way that human beings process information. There's a reason why Hollywood has reigned supreme, because it makes sense to us as human beings. Mm-hmm. It gives us an ability to go out and deviate from that model. I think other great cinematic film traditions have looked at what's happened and taken what they can from American filmmaking and the Hollywood tradition and learned to subvert it. And I think that's what Canada does very well, is sort of subvert these elegant truisms that Hollywood has offered.
Do you have a favorite scene in The Sweet Hereafter?
The scene that always makes me cry in that particular film is the flashback scene, the in-home thinking back on the day that he saved his daughter's life. His daughter's a drug user, and he gives us this story about when she was a child, and there was this perfect harmony, there was this idyllic vision of what a family should be, and there's just an overhead shot, sort of like a godlike eye down on the world, and there's a sleeping mother and a sleeping father and this beautiful cherubic child sandwiched between them, which is sort of this beautiful, it's the ideal, right? It's the human ideal. It's safety and all things comforting. And then he tells us that he had to cut her open in order to save her life, that she'd been stung by a bee, that her throat was closing. The idea of taking the blade to his child's throat and the anxiety that he, and the emotion that he has in his voice as he's telling us that moment, that in order to save her, he had to nearly kill her, that he had to violate his daughter's skin, and sort of the whole Abraham thing, and a variety of different images come into play. But I think just the raw emotion in Holmes' voice and that picture, and understanding in that moment how much he truly loves his daughter, how much he would do to save her, that intangible bond between a parent and child, and that's what gave the movie its emotional force. And that's the scene that started to make me cry. And after that scene, I didn't stop crying. I was crying all the way till the tail credit.
It was an unforgettable drive. I was divided into two parts. One part was Daddy singing a lullaby to his little girl, and the other part was a surgeon with a knife ready to cut into her throat. I waited for the second Zoe's breath stopped to make the incision.
What happened? What happened?
Oh, nothing. We got to the hospital in time. I did not have to go as far as I was prepared to go. But I was prepared to go all the way.
I want to ask you about a film that I think is considered a kind of archetypal Canadian film, Guy Maddin's movie, Careful.
Oh, Careful. Oh, absolutely. Definitely a seminal and very much emblematic of what Canada does. We've got the maple leaf flags waving all the way through it. We've got broken language. Language is something that tends to get broken as a result of our linguistic differences in this country, that we have two mother tongues and we have a First Nations reality, which puts us all into context. I think Guy Maddin's work, it's black and white. It harkens back to sort of the Leni Riefenstahl Mountain films that were made. He uses sort of Nordic language, a sort of nefarious Nordic tongue that never really makes sense. We have a father and a daughter madly in love with her father without him knowing. And we have people, they have to be very careful in their little town because there's this constant risk of avalanches. So in order to survive, people must be quiet. And that tends to be, I mean, if you look at Canada's place in the political reality as it is, we tend to be very quiet.
So that's what careful means. These are people who all have to walk around speaking in very soft voices.
Absolutely. You don't want to trigger an avalanche to come and kill everybody. And I think, you know, Canada's often called the mouse next to the elephant. We don't want to get stepped on. I mean, I think every Canadian is well aware of the fact that if for some reason we really upset our neighbors down south, that we'd have tanks moving in tomorrow, that there would be a no contest fight. Obviously, we don't think that would ever happen, but there's always this don't upset the tea kettle, you know? Just let's everybody just be calm and be polite, and Canadians are notoriously polite. If you bang into us, we'll say we're sorry. This is just the Canadian way. Our key to survival has been to lay low, stay quiet, and maybe the polar bear or the grizzly bear will walk by you if you play dead.
What's the best scene in Careful?
Oh, well, that's just a beautiful movie. I think the scene that sticks with me is when the woman who lusts after her father, she decides to lead these people into her little ice cave where they all decide to freeze to death, or she sort of lures them into freezing to death, which I think is sort of another great way. I mean, and, you know, people have gone out there and subverted that whole idea of freezing to death. There's a lot of freezing by death in Canadian film. No great mystery there. But one of my favorite examples is Highway 61 starts off with a corpse that's found dead in a bathtub. And then their job is to take this frozen corpse all the way down south. And they go along Highway 61 to bring the corpse back. So there's quite a lot of dark humor. The films are very dark, but they're also quite funny. I think if you look between them, the lines, and you sort of just find a little breathing room between the frames, you'll find that there's actually quite a lot of humor. And I think Guy Madden is wonderfully funny. I mean, the saddest music in the world. If you're sad and you like beer, I'm your lady. There's a lot of humor to be found in the works of even the darkest Canadian auteurs.
Listen to the sounds of Winnipeg, the wide breathing of a nocturnal city in this sad, sad world. We at Musket Beer are proud that Winnipeg has been chosen 4 years in a row by the London Times as the world capital of sorrow in the Great Depression. In recognition of this honor, we will be hosting a worldwide contest to determine which nation's music truly deserves to be called the saddest in the world. Aspiring virtuosos of tearful melody are welcome to travel here and lay claim to the jewel-studded crown of frozen tears and $25,000 in prize money. That's right. $25,000 Depression era dollars.
It's Isabella Rossellini in a scene from Guy Madden's film The Saddest Music in the World. Catherine Monk is the author of Weird Sex and Snowshoes and other Canadian film phenomena. She spoke with Anne Strainchamps. And here is music from The Saddest Music in the World. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a cassette copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 19A, Blame Canada. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at www.ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Mary Lou Finnegan, Anne Strainchamps, Charles Monroe Kane, Doug Gordon, and Veronica Rickard, with engineering help from Marv Nunn and Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.